The program, which follows a documentary about conscientious objection and draft resistance during the war in Vietnam, contains language which you may find offensive.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, "This is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you. Here's a..."
I feel like there's two kinds of COs. One is, I feel like there was the chickens, whom I have no respect for. And the other category is the guys who, I think they knew a hell of a lot more about what was going on than I did. Because if I had it to do over, I would be in the latter category. The chicken shits, I feel like that they've got their own hell that they've got to go through. Because someday they're going to have to face that to the fact that they were just too damn scared to make a decision right or wrong.
The choice to me was clear that it was, and at that time some folks were going to Canada. That was out of the question for me. Not because I felt they were necessarily wrong, but because I felt my country was wrong and that I needed to be here to stand in judgment of my country, even if it meant going to jail and paying that price. And I'm not a super patriot, but I am an American, and this is my country, and I do care, and I do care about liberty and justice for all.
I was leaving my country. I was leaving my country. Mr. Strait, who had always played it right, I thought, God, how's this happening? And then I probably will never be able to go back, and my parents will disown me because I was chicken. I don't know, because I didn't believe in the war, because I was still sane. I don't know. You know, that's what I tell myself now.
What if you would have believed in the war?
I would have gone. I had to go.
In one instance, we stole, we removed the draft records from a draft board and returned them to all of their owners and said, "We're giving you a second chance. The government now has lost all record of your draft status. It's unlikely they will ever contact you again. If they do, you are at no fault. It's nothing you did. We encourage you to join us in work in stopping the war."
You got your 1A. Your response was to do what?
I ate it. I ate it. I never burned the draft card. I have two of them to this day.
You mean you ate it? What do you mean you chewed it up and swallowed it?
That was my initial response. It's a greeting. You've been selected by your... That's it. I don't want to hear about the free donuts and the train ride.
The memory of the war in Vietnam is still fresh in the mind of America. During the time of that conflict, the opposition to military service, especially the open and vocal opposition, was without precedent in this nation's history. New Supreme Court decisions extended the basis for objection beyond that of earlier wars to include those who objected solely for moral or ethical reasons, without a direct connection to any religion. Excluded, however, were those who objected specifically to the war in Vietnam, which came to be called selective objection. For these young men, who probably comprised the vast majority, there were several choices: to broaden their objection to include all wars, to claim another exemption, such as a medical deferment, to leave the country, most likely to Canada, to go underground, or to serve in the military. At the same time, many of those serving in Vietnam were influenced by their experiences and by the growing public opposition to the war to look for a way out, which often was the Underground Railroad to Canada. So numerous were those granted objector status that there were not enough alternative service positions for them to satisfy their 2-year obligation to selective service, and many of them never did. So numerous were those who violated federal law by refusing induction that courts in some jurisdictions had a backlog of from 2 to 3 years for the hearing of selective service cases. The knowledge of this within the resistance movement helped increase the backlog as young men traveled considerable distances to refuse induction where the wait was long or the outcome was likely favorable. One young man who did not seek a favorable jurisdiction was Curtis Chappell, who instead chose to use his trial as an opportunity to express publicly his opposition to the war in Vietnam. Chappell's opposition to the war and to the draft was influenced by a speech which he heard by Joan Baez.
That summer, I went to Hood's Canal. The Fellowship of Reconciliation was having a conference over there, and I heard Joan Baez speak. She was talking about David Harris and draft resistance and conscience and the Center for Nonviolent Study in Palo Alto, and she was saying that if you're opposed to wars and killing people, then you can't really, really get an exemption from a system that you're opposed to in the first place, which is what David Harris's position was. Mm-hmm. And I heard that. I didn't know quite what she was talking about. I knew it meant something for me, but the draft wasn't quite present for me yet. And so I had a chance to sort of like regurgitate for me. I went to anti-war marches. I have a sculptor friend, Rich Beyer, who I used to go down and visit, and we'd make posters in his shop, his artist's shop, and handmade ones, and go marching down the street. And I thought about it a lot. And one day, Rich set me down in his shop. He says, "Listen, you know, I don't want to see you go to jail, and I know you don't want to go fight in Vietnam. Fill out the CO form." And he sat me down at his workbench, and I tried to fill out the CO form. And I got about three-quarters of the way through, and I realized, this doesn't fit me. Something that Joan Baez had said had sparked something somewhere. I remembered some quotation from Benjamin Franklin that conscription is slavery. And I thought, you know, if it's a free and just society and there's a war that needs to be fought, you don't need to conscript men to fight it. They'll volunteer. And that's why we were having such a bad time in Vietnam, is that it was so unjust over there. There was no way we were going to win against those people. They all came front forward and fought us. And about 3 weeks later, I just said, the heck with it. And got together with other men in Seattle and formed a chapter of the Resistance, which was the organization David Harris had started. And we started, got our draft cards together and took them down en masse and gave them back to Selective Service and said, here, if it wasn't for you people, drafting people, we wouldn't have this war, because no, we would fight it because it's immoral, not right, and unjust, and the whole thing anyway.
Curtis Chapel dropped out of college, was reclassified 1A, eligible for induction, and was sent a notice to appear at the induction center.
People organized a demonstration. We went down to the induction center, and I gave everybody a can of spray paint, orange spray paint, and they put their favorite anti-war slogan on my Cadillac hearse out front of the induction center while I was inside. Walked inside and started singing wobbly songs. Do you know how they go? Onward, Christian soldiers, murders, smite and kill. Kill your Christian neighbors, or by him be killed, etc. And refused to participate in the induction process. Didn't fill out the forms. When we went to take the tests, they'd give you a test form, and I'd turn it over, and I'd write, "Wars will cease when men refuse to fight on it." And it's everybody has to be quiet, so I'd write it in big block letters and hold it up in the test room. And just basically not be an ass, you know, not like be belligerent, but just start talking to people in the induction line, you know, why are you doing this, like that. And about 2 hours later, they came and put two big guys on both sides of me and carried me out.
Curtis Chapel's uncooperative behavior at the induction center resulted in his arrest, indictment, and trial. He intended to use his day in court as an opportunity for making his statement against the war.
I was begged to take a court-appointed lawyer. And I said, well, that's fine, as long as I get to speak in my behalf. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. So they appointed me a lawyer. And he was a young fellow just out of law school. I said, listen, Bob, we're not going to argue, right or wrong, you know, that I refused induction. He said, well, you got to, you know, I said, no. We're going to talk straight to the jury. This is a jury of my peers. And we'll tell them just flat out what the situation is here. I directed it. It was the only way I would have it. It's, you know, he was the lawyer, and he did the lawyer's job. But I said, this is the way I want to be defended. So we never said I didn't refuse induction or anything. We talked about the whole thing. The judge I had was named Judge Beeks. He was the hanging judge of the Western District. Until I got him, or he got me, or we got each other, he only sent you up for 5 years. You're either guilty or innocent, and if you're guilty, you went to jail for 5 years, and if you're innocent, you didn't go to jail. And what happened was he came across me. He said, you know, if you had applied for your CO status and continued with it and they denied it to you and this came to court, I would have mandated the Selective Service to give you a CO status. But you won't take it. So I'm in a moral dilemma here. See, put him in a bind. I'm the one going to jail, but he was in the bind. So at any rate, the jury was out, and it was out for a while. They came back. They walked in, not one of them looked at me. It was the most incredible experience you've ever had. You sense something's coming, and you, for me, I didn't know what it was. I couldn't believe that it could be conviction, and it was.
Curtis Chappell was given a suspended sentence on the condition that he perform 2 years of public service work like the alternative service given a conscientious objector.
The work I was given was as an orderly in a hospital. I continued to protest the war. I continued to carry picket signs. I continued to hand out literature. And about 6 months later, they sent me another draft card. It was 4F. 4F being that I was a convicted felon, right? So now that I'm a convicted felon, you know, the Alice's Restaurant story, I'm not fit for killing people because I'm a felon, see. But they sent me a draft card, and I was working that night, and I got the draft card, and I looked at the draft card, and the only thing I could see was blood. Because to me, in how I held it, that's what it represented. Without a draft, it wouldn't be the bloodshed. So I took it down to work, and in a basin of blood that came out after a surgery, I dipped the draft card in the blood, let it dry in my locker, and took it down to Selective Service the next day. It was just a gorgeous representation of the war for me, this Selective Service card, even though it said 4F on it, with red streaks of human blood dried on it. And I took it down, and I went to see my draft board, and I put it in her hand, and I said, and it was dry. I said, here, if it wasn't for you doing your job, we wouldn't have the murder and bloodshed. So the blood's on your hands, not on mine. And walked out. And 3 days later, I was arrested again.
For that action, Chappell was found in violation of the conditions of his probation, even though the written conditions said nothing about refraining from anti-war activities. He was sent to a federal prison for a psychiatric evaluation.
Prison was a whole other thing. It was great. I had a great time and a terrible time in prison. Prison was prison. That's the bottom line on that.
See, what was great about it?
I had a vision, and who I was went with me to prison. I continued to talk to the prison officials and to the prisoners and everybody else about peace and war and issues like that. And they're just as relevant and present, only in different ways in prison as they are out here. I was threatened the first week I was there with a knife. I looked at the guy and got what he had to say and backed off. And later on, a month later, the same man walked up to me and said, if anybody messes with you, you tell me and I'll take care of him. And I was able to generate some respect, at least, with the prisoners. So you basically began to learn to live with another segment of humanity that you may not have been with all your life. Like, that's what I'm saying, it's an opportunity. It was an opportunity to see another side of humanity in the raw as a participant and to see how society responds to that, which is not well at all.
When you were there?
I'm now discovering that. I'll tell you something about what I've discovered is that when you have a vision and a purpose, it doesn't matter what gets in your way. And for me, my personal safety was not as important as what I was thinking about in the vision I have.
What's the vision?
That there's sufficiency and abundance on this planet for all of us. That human differences, that angers and fears and conflict can be resolved without having to kill each other.
Chappell's prison sentence was appealed successfully to the United States Supreme Court, and he was released. While Selective Service could have attempted to draft him once again, they quietly left him alone, most likely to avoid bringing further attention to the cause of draft resistance. Curtis Chappell is now an electrical contractor in Seattle. While hundreds of thousands of men were attempting to stay out of the military, others already enlisted or drafted were trying to get out. John Strait was one of the first officers ever to gain discharge from the United States Navy as a conscientious objector. He had enlisted through his college ROTC program, but gradually developed a moral belief which precluded further service.
I don't believe that wars ever function on the basis on which they're sold. I think that the national and international interests that are fought out using war as a mechanism inevitably fail. I think if there's anything that history tends to emphasize, it is that war as a tool of human organization has failed utterly. At a moral and religious level, I guess part of it comes from the Holocaust. The essence of hatred to the point where one can engage in something like the Holocaust as a participant is the dehumanization of the group that you're attacking, the group that you're destroying. They're not human. And that was the one sine qua non that I saw in my studies of the Holocaust. was that that it simply wouldn't have been possible had one kept reminding oneself of the humanity of those who one was affecting. It simply couldn't have happened either as policy or process. The essence of being able to kill in war is you dehumanize the enemy. And I was quite conscious of the training process I was going through at Fort Lewis, where the cadre that were instructing us, whenever you were trained in any methodologies of killing, in any tactics of destroying, how the first and foremost premise was humanizing yourself and your own men and dehumanizing whatever it might be you would be fighting against. I thought it was very effective training.
Each branch of the military has a procedure for requesting discharge as a conscientious objector. These procedures involve several interviews, a hearing, and then the approval or disapproval by a National Review Board in Washington, D.C.
I decided I'd file a CO claim from within the military. There was a regulation procedure where an officer or an enlisted man...
What was your first move?
I literally went to a quiet place and sat and agonized over it for about 3 days and decided I was going to do it. And then started working on my CO application, and I... It's the first time I'd really sat down and tried to write out what I'd been thinking and wrote and wrote and wrote. I think I wrote about 35 pages the first time I sat down. Then looked at it, put it away for a couple of days, came back to it, wrote some more, and then filed the application. In retrospect, it seems incredibly naive. I guess I really thought that somehow the world would collapse on my head. To me, it seemed like the ultimate break with everything I'd been aiming for. I really agonized over the decision. Then, when I filed the CO claim, I got immediate orders to activation. I wrote back a letter and pointed out that under the regs they couldn't do that. They had to process the claim first. Then I had to go see a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist decided that I was not crazy. And then I had a hearing with an officer of captain's rank or higher, who was a man named Donald Zagretti. Donald Zagretti, of course, later became notorious as one of the dirty tricksters in the Watergate scandals, and he wrote a favorable report.
But the National Board rejected John Strait's claim. There followed a succession of moves and counter-moves, like a game of chess, where the Navy would order Strait to active duty and Strait would gain court intervention. But time was running out for John Strait when he traveled to the summer cottage of the late Justice William O. Douglas, from whom he requested a stay of his order to active duty.
Douglas met us at the door of the cabin, invited us in, and sat us down. I said, okay, who's going to argue this, you or you, Mr. Steinward? I said, well, I'm going to. Mr. Steinward is really just here to introduce me, to get me here physically. So I started arguing this day. At that time, there wasn't much in the way of handbooks about what this process was. I mean, it wasn't done very often. It was very unusual. Nobody really knew about it except by word of mouth. And I started out with what I thought were the strongest issues, and he kept shaking his head, saying, no, I don't even think I'd vote for cert on that. It was getting increasingly negative. I was getting more and more vociferous and aggressive because I could see this thing going down the tubes. And all of a sudden, he said, excuse me for a minute, Mr. Strait. And he got up and went into the bathroom, which was off the living room. He was gone for a little bit. And he came back, and he had a pad of Supreme Court stationery, which was hanging next to the toilet in the bathroom. And he had written on this pad the following: I, Associate Justice William O. Douglas of the United States Supreme Court, do hereby stay the orders to activation of First Lieutenant John A. Strait until such time as the case is finally decided on the merits. Period. Signed, William O. Douglas.
Strait's claim did go to the Supreme Court, which upheld a lower court's decision in his favor. Though his discharge was still years in the future, he never did report for active duty. While all this was taking place, the Navy made numerous offers of non-combatant assignments.
There were people who strongly suggested to me in informal contexts that if I were just to drop this whole thing, they'd find a niche for me and I wouldn't have to go risk my little tuchus. That was the implication of the statements. And at one time, there was even a formal offer of compromise, not in writing.
Why did you not accept any of those?
Well, I mean, I wasn't doing it because I was afraid of getting shot. I wasn't doing it because I felt that Vietnam was specifically the problem. I mean, it was and is a matter of moral question to me.
John Strait is now a lawyer and a professor of law at the University of Puget Sound.
Oh, my name. It ain't none. nothing. My age, it means less.
Since before World War II, Selective Service has recognized two types of conscientious objectors: those who serve in the military but not in combat, and those who perform other service outside the military. Rick Landry was a non-combatant conscientious objector assigned by the Navy to be a medic.
Well, when I entered the military, I made a point upon entry that I wasn't going to carry a weapon. And everyone tried to talk me out of it, achieving that status. But here my father was, again, a very strong presence and influenced me to retain that position. So I did. It sort of necessitated that I become a hospital corpsman in the Navy. There weren't too many other classifications that wouldn't be required to bear a gun at some conflict. So that's what I became. That's what I signed up for out of boot camp. I went right to corps school. I had no idea, even at that point yet, that Navy hospital corpsmen were being used in Vietnam. And 3 days after I was in Vietnam, I was in heavy conflict. I was pulling KIAs out of the back of a truck under fire on my way to Khe Sanh, which of course was Dien Bien Phu that my father used to tell me about. And there I was, a stranger in a strange land, and still sympathizing with the Vietnamese people, feeling that perhaps I could perform some good and charity while I was there in the sense of being a corpsman and carrying out my medical duties, because we took care of a lot of Vietnamese as well as Americans. My first patient was a Vietnamese, a 15-year-old Montagnard tribes person, and washing clothes at the river and took shrapnel in the face. And a couple of Marines brought her to me, and I had no idea what to do. All my book learning and the classroom situation escaped me, and I was dumbfounded at the horror of her wound. And this was incredible to me, and it remains incredible. We're under fire. White phosphorus is filtering down through the beautiful blue cerulean sky, and it looks harmless and wonderful, but it will burn right through you from one side out the other and through your bone. And rockets are coming in and hitting the ammo dumps, and here's this 15-year-old girl who's missing half of her face, and her airways beginning to close off trauma due to swelling, and she's gasping and dying and pitched over in the sand, and sand is clinging to her wound. The captain came striding out of the battalion aid station with his white smock on and a little stubby cigar, mumbled something about her heritage and kicked her in the back over into the sand, accusing her of having set off a claymore and having injured herself. Wouldn't take care of her, turned around, went back into the battalion aid station. Now, that was so self-defeating to me, because there went the last straw of sensibility. I thought, in the very least, I could be there to help those people. And that began... That was my third day in country on my way to Khe Sanh. We were under attack for 3 days and nights. Later, when I arrived at my duty station, they would assign me a weapon, a .45 caliber pistol, and I was to sign for it. It would now become mine. And I argued with him that I would not carry a weapon. That's one of the reasons I was a corpsman. I would still not take the weapon, and they increased the pressure on me to do so by charging me for it each time I wouldn't take it. The next day or a couple of days later, they'd ask to see my weapon for inspection purposes. And I said, I didn't take that. It's still on the desk. And if I couldn't produce it, then it came out of my pay. And they did that to me a couple of times when I first got in country. And then they stopped doing that and they left me alone. And I just performed my job. I saved lives and I took lives. I performed euthanasia, which of course you're not supposed to do. I helped other military men get out of the service. I helped them increase their level of disability so that they would receive their medical board and be discharged due to a medical discharge. These were the guys that were like-minded. I'm thankful for those people like myself that were there, that were opposed to the war, but were there. If it had all been the gung-ho Mustangers who wanted to wipe out the Vietnamese, it would have been even worse.
Rick Landry's experiences in Vietnam changed his feelings about owning a weapon and about using it under certain circumstances.
Intelligence officers were trying to extract information in this one village that we were in to do, like, dental work and health
immunizations. It was a routine thing, and this was going on at the same time. And this woman was pleading with these ROC officers that she didn't know what they wanted to know. Meanwhile, they're holding her, about a two-year-old, I would say, maybe a little less than that, by the ankles over the village well, threatening to drop her in if she didn't say. And she was going nuts, berserk. She didn't know. She was screaming, she didn't know. Then they pitched the baby in. And if that was my own son or someone I knew, or I would pick up the gun and I would put down the gun in the words of Mao Zedong. There's a time that I think it's necessary, because evil does exist in the world and madness does exist. And so I guess it changed me, changed my mind a lot. Of course, keep in mind, I returned from Vietnam 15 years ago, two tours there, and I am today diagnosed as having post-traumatic stress disorder in high-stress situations that, to me, roughly parallel situations I found myself in Vietnam. I get very stressed out, very uptight, quickly.
I asked Rick Landry when his response might be a violent one and whether he would fight in wartime conflict.
It's to protect what one loves more than one's own life, one's around them, my son, my wife, my family. I would, in a forced situation like that, my homeland being invaded, highly unlikely. I really can't make a hypothetical projection about that.
If it comes up to time for Jesse to be 18 and there's a draft, right?
Yes.
How do you think you'll counsel Jesse?
Well, I'll try to pass on the wisdom of my father's point of view and perspective, and accept his decision. I would encourage him not to become gun fodder, to explain to him how elementally we are considered as expendable by our government, and how generals and colonels and officers and captains foremost know that they are there to order you into death, even if it's for sacrificial purposes, and you are merely expendable, exposable, just another six-pack to be thrown out.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Former draft board member Lois Urim.
When I first went on the board, the conscientious objectors would submit their claim, and it was almost impossible at that time to give them a seal. They had to have all kinds of documentation. It had to be almost a life and death case before they would be granted a CO status. By the time 1974 came along, our hands were almost tied not to give them a CO. The rules and the laws had changed that much in 4 years' time. At that time, we had many, many of them that came through that we knew in our own hearts that they just simply didn't want to go in the service. Not because they really objected, because some of the reasons they would give were so flimsy and outlandish that you knew that they just simply wanted to avoid the draft.
Draft counselor Duncan Saunders.
Almost to a man, they didn't want to serve in Vietnam. I mean, it was a sense of, and a lot of them told me, I would fight if this country were attacked. There's no question about that. But I am not going to go to a war, 10, 8,000 miles away for something that doesn't seem to be making any sense. I really won't. What else can I do?
I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in and sat down. Got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that
I'd
morning.
Say not that many went COs, because there were more options open. At one point we had even agricultural, fatherhood, vocational ones that we no longer have. So a lot of people fell into other categories than the CO, and a lot of them did have hardship We had attorneys and physicians and psychiatrists that we referred to on a regular basis, and a lot of people had legitimate grounds for getting, let's say, a medical. But in talking with most of those people, if that failed, they would probably, if they couldn't get into Canada, and not all of them even wanted to go to Canada, they would either refuse induction and or file as conscientious objectors. And so I would say the majority of people we talked to were at one point or another conscientious objectors, and we would say, you know, hey, we won't help you do anything illegitimate. What we're going to do is it's going to be legit. And so sometimes when all those avenues were exhausted, then they would turn to the CO route. And because we gave them counseling, they usually got it. Again, it came back if you were white and middle class and articulate and could read and write well, you stood a far better chance.
I didn't have the courage to go through the official CO things, and I'm really kind of ashamed about that. Because that's where my heart was. That was where my thinking was, really, that war sucks. War is just fucking stupid, and I don't want any part of it.
I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and
I know one time I went in with my bag packed, expecting to go. Said goodbye to my parents. That was really close. That was crazy. But during those the few weeks or months before that, I developed a medical condition which looked like VD of some kind. And I went to a doctor, and all I said was, I'm about to be called into the military, and if this, whatever this condition is that I have, if it'll get me out, or if there's something about it that they should know about, or then I need to know it right away, and I need it in writing so I can give it to them. So he just looked at me and said, do you want to be in the Army? And I said, no. So he wrote down on a little prescription sheet to whom it may concern, Lawrence Hanks has chronic prostatitis, which is under good control. So I showed up at the draft board with my bag packed, and I showed them that piece of paper, and they scratched me off without even blinking, just quick as a flash. I was relieved.
I know a gentleman in Seattle, a middle class type of upbringing, just fought his way out of it, and he's proud of it, you know, not because of any overwhelming moral convictions about killing anybody, just because he didn't want to get his ass dusted. I got real mad at him when I was talking with him. I showed him a scar on my back, and I said, you know, that's your scar, but it's on my body.
Canadian immigration officials estimate that somewhere upwards of 50,000 young Americans entered Canada to escape military service during the war in Vietnam. One of these young men was Dale Harriet, who now lives in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I don't know when I decided to come to Canada. Well, I felt alienated in the United States at the time because, well, one, I was living outside the law. You know, my crime was that of inaction. I hadn't really committed a crime, and here I was considered a felon. And as far as I was concerned, that wasn't right. So I felt very alienated and heard that more and more people were going to Canada. So
you got your 1A. Your response was to do what?
I ate it. I think I ate it. I never burned a draft card. I have two of them to this day.
You mean you ate it?
Yep.
What do you mean? You mean you chewed it up and swallowed it?
Yep. Reading, you've been selected by your... That's it. I don't want to hear about the free donuts and the train ride.
Did they send you another one?
I don't know. They would have sent it to my mother's house. And within a week after I was supposed to show up there, I was never at my mother's house again. And for the next 16 months, she didn't know where I was.
As the FBI closed in on Dale Harriet, the urgency of his crossing the border increased. He chose as his escape vehicle his bicycle.
For the last 10 miles, coming out of Minnesota and into Manitoba, where I expected the four-door Ford to pull over any minute, say, nice try, kid, but, you know, one in the Army.
What's the border crossing like there?
Oh, it was one man in a small card house, and says, hi, where are you going? It says, San Diego, you know. And he goes, oh, you're going the wrong way, aren't you? I says, well, I'm going to ride across Canada, maybe put the bike on the train. And he says, you got any money? I says, $300 stuck in the handlebars here. He goes, have a nice time in Canada. I cycled about another half mile down the road, got off the bike, kissed the ground, ate a handful of dirt, you know. I made it. So then I went in Winnipeg. I contacted the Winnipeg Committee to Aid War Objectors, and they arranged for a ride down to the United States and turn around. And I came back through Emerson, Manitoba.
What's that for?
You could get 10 extra points for applying at the border, apply for landed immigrant status. So that was a hairy run. Some fellow picked me up in the car one morning, and, you know, this had all been prepared. I had a suit on, and I had my story together, and he had an envelope with some identification and a bunch of cash. We went down into the United States as one person, went and had a hamburger, and came back at Emerson and said, where are you going? I'd like to apply for landed immigrant status. I had a written job offer.
With his written job offer in hand, Dale Harriet was granted landed immigrant status and went to work as a sous chef in Winnipeg. He eventually did cross Canada to the West Coast, but never crossed the border south towards San Diego. Later, he applied for Canadian citizenship. I asked him why.
I needed refuge, and they offered it. So by becoming a citizen, it was sort of like marrying the country. Putting something back into it.
Does your obligation include fighting to defend Canada should that ever be needed?
I could picture myself as a guerrilla, yeah. In the hinterland of British Columbia, keeping the insurgents, the invaders from the south or from the north, you know, right between Russia and the United States. A lot of resources in Canada, not too many people. It's an easy target. It would have been the same way if the Vietnamese had been, you know, waging their war in Texas. I would have felt a lot differently about it, but not in Southeast Asia. If Canada was involved in Sri Lanka, I wouldn't go.
We played frisbee across the Peace Arch Park, and we took garden tours. We had picnics. Yeah, you just look at the gardens, and you wander from the United States to Canada. And frequently it was Dick or whoever we were cooperating with would drop the other party off on the U.S. side. We'd look at the gardens, take pictures, walk through the arches, just go on over to the Canadian side and eventually be picked up on the other side. In one case, we met with a group of people from Canada and we picnicked together, and then we just left one or two people short and they left one or two people in addition.
I would either rent or borrow boats, and I would take them on fishing trips, dress them up appropriately, take them on fishing trips. You have to keep in mind that these guys often came out of the brig. They had no hair. They looked military, and so it was tricky.
A couple months later, here we are coming back again. And on the trip back, we took the coast route and down the Redwood Highway, and it was quite scenic. And I got a real feeling of, you know, being kind of connected to the land and the country. And the song, the Woody Guthrie song, "This Land Is Your Land," kept kind of going through my mind. And And I just kind of figured right then, I said, I can't leave here. You know, I can't leave and never come back.
She stopped on the American side, parked on the American side, and my son and this young man got out with a Frisbee, and they played Frisbee on the lawn from the American side over to the Canadian side. They played Frisbee for about a half an hour and gradually worked their way over, got in the car, and went on up to Canada.
The closest thing to a welcoming committee for these young Americans was the Committee to Aid American War Objectors, generally simply called the Committee. Larry Martin, for 15 years active with the committee, himself emigrated to Canada to avoid serving in Vietnam.
The organization is the Committee to Aid American War Objectors, and it was started in about 1964, 65 to help people immigrate to Canada because of Vietnam, and I've been working pretty much actively since I got here, which was around 1969. When people first arrived, we helped people get places to stay. We had a list of homes who would take in American war objectors, and we also ran a hostel. And for about 3 years of my work with the War Objectors Committee, I ran the hostel for deserters and draft dodgers. And we also helped people find jobs, mainly job offers so they could immigrate to Canada. And we helped them with immigration counseling. We told them what to expect and what to bring when they went for immigration.
Do you have any sense at all of how many young Americans were helped by the committee between 64, say, and 73?
We were seeing at times upwards of 60 people a week, but the figures that we normally go by are Canada-wide is what we've tried to put together from Department of Immigration figures is that about 70,000 people immigrated during the Vietnam era, and that's not counting or quite a few families who brought their sons up who are reaching draft age. And anyway, 70,000 is the basic figure, there. And we're not trying to build up figures. That seems to be fairly accurate. I think basically the immigration to Canada during that time was certainly approved by the American government as a steam valve. Putting 70,000 people in jails might have brought the war to a head quicker.
So the hostel that you ran, how many people could stay there at a time, say?
I had about a two-bedroom house with a full basement. It was right in the center of Kitsilano in Vancouver, which is hippie town, and I had about 15 to 35 people living there. We had rugs dividing rooms in the basement, like the General Pershing suite. We named all these various rooms. People were sleeping in the pantry and under the kitchen table, surviving on very little money. The only kind of work these war objectors could do was stuff for cash. I did it lots of times too, delivering leaflets, which was 12 bucks a day, 8 hours, and mowing lawns. I shoveled snow a few times, and we also sold the local underground paper on the street, the Georgia Strait, which sold for a quarter, and the vendor got a dime. And you could make, you know, a buck and a half or 2 bucks an hour. The hostel charged a dollar and a half day rent, and that included the place to sleep in, whatever food we could get together. We found ways of getting food real cheap. I was serving 25 people on, you know, $8.
Generalizations are tough, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. Who was coming across? Why were they doing it? And what became of them?
Everybody was coming across for every reason, and they're everywhere now. I mean, there was as many reasons as there were people. And early on, we decided that the committee that we'd help anybody. We decided that the main thing was to take people out of the war machine. And I still run into a lot of war objectors. I'll get on a bus and the guy remembers, the bus driver remembers me from 15 years ago when I counseled him. One time I was moving into an apartment and the guy installing the phone was a deserter. And I was in an interview on CBC television, and the cameraman working for the CBC, which is the government television, was an illegal immigrant who was a deserter. And there's a whole lot of people, war objectors, who are in social work. And there's a whole lot of people involved in the media. One of the best reporters around Vancouver is a former war objector. And there's lots of people in the theater and music who are, you know, war objectors from the States.
Do you have any sense at all of what proportion stayed?
I kept really close contact because people were calling me to find out if they were still wanted or not, and we got a lot of publicity, and I was on the phone about 10 to 14 hours a day during those times, and hardly anybody went back. You know, I put it at maybe 10%, maybe 15. I didn't generate this phrase, but it was a reverse brain drain is what happened. It was that the cream of Canadians used to go down to the States, and a lot of people saying there's a lot of very worthwhile individuals that immigrated during the Vietnam War.
Basically, we got dropped off. We got off the road quickly. And then we pretty much stayed in one area for about 15, 20 minutes in the brush, waiting. If that all went fine, because at that point we were just hikers, right? Until you get up to the line, then you're no longer a hiker. And you go over two hills and down through a couple little valleys and across the creek and through a swampy area. We chose the swampy area more often than anything else. It was rough going. It was rough going for us. It was rough going for anybody else. And water pretty much covers up a lot of track, a lot of sand. Then it was a straight shot down through this one little valley. And we had to skirt kind of an open place in a little glen and through an alder stand over another little hill. And then you come within, 1,000 yards of this access road that was on the Canadian line. And it was generally at night. And then as soon as they came around that one corner, they blinked their lights a couple times. We had a flashlight, blink it once, and then from that on, all lights would go out. People would be loaded up, they'd be on their way, and we'd be on our way back. And
I'm curious how much your training in Vietnam helped you.
A whole bunch. We all were Vietnam veterans.
I knew of two captains in the Marine Corps. I was an officer. They quit in the middle of a war. They flat-ass quit. And I don't mean they said I wasn't going to do it anymore. They packed their bags. This is something the Marine Corps does not like to talk about. They packed their bags, got on a helicopter, which a good friend of mine delivered them, down to Tansanute, and they flew out of there. They managed to get to Hawaii. Nobody questioned them. They're two officers in uniform. And the unit that I was in got a postcard from Brazil.
Canada, your misty mountains took me in. I didn't realize back then the time would hold me and you.
Among those who fled to Canada, many were already in the military and had already served in Vietnam. But Ed Kopira, who now lives in Victoria, British Columbia, was drafted. He went willingly, unlike a number of his friends.
I did not view the circumstances the same way most people did, or a lot of my friends did, I should say, who were at that time very much a part of the conscientious objection position. Or of the draft dodger or deserter position, depending on where they were with the military. I myself was in a position of, let's go there, let's find out, let's see who's doing what, why, and come out with, you know, an informed decision. I did. I did.
Okay, and how long were you there before you came to your decision?
A little less than about 3 days.
What happened in those 3 days?
I arrived in Cameron Bay the first day. I was shipped to Bong Song the second day. And
You'd already done basic training, though, right?
Yes, I did basic training and advanced individual training, AIT. And I was sent to Bong Song. I arrived in Bong Song my second day. I was sent out on a patrol as an introduction to the country. And on the way out of camp, you happen to pass a series of stake poles that are set up, about six of them. And on top of each one was a head of supposedly Viet Cong individuals who were caught and captured by the Korean soldiers, the ROKs. And during the period of questioning, somehow their head came off. And that pretty much turned my thinking around right away. You can't get answers from a head. And if people are going to go to that extent, then something's wrong. Something's not, you know, I understand it's a war. I'm aware of that. But nonetheless, something didn't gel.
So what was the matter? What was wrong with this whole Vietnam experience as far as you're concerned?
We had no purpose. I probably would have stuck it out had we the support, had we a direct enemy, had we a frontline condition. We had none of these things. You didn't know who the enemy was. You never knew where the front line was. You never really knew what you were fighting for. And most of the time I was there, it was under pacification, so you never really could fight. All you could do was duck. You get very disenchanted and very disappointed with the people who sent you there.
After one tour in Vietnam, Ed Kopira asked to be assigned elsewhere, based upon an army rule which restricts the number of members of one family assigned to combat areas. His request was denied.
I found out 2 days later, my orders had been cut. My brother had been shipped from Vietnam. He was no longer there. I was to report on a Monday morning to the tarmac and get on the plane and fly back to Vietnam as a combat experience veteran to serve my last 6 months in Vietnam. Knowing that most people died either in their first 2 weeks or in their last 2 weeks, I had no intention. So I got some friends of mine in Los Angeles who were very close to me and knew the circumstances that were going on, who I kept in touch with all the time. Explained the situation, told them I just could not do it. I just physically could not do it. I've never experienced that before in my life. That was the first time. By Monday, I was in Los Angeles. 1 week Monday, I was in Vancouver.
Where did you go?
Vancouver, directly, and got a hotel room that night, and by the next morning, I was over to the Committee to Aid American War Objectors.
Two successive presidents, Ford and Carter, opened the border, though conditionally, to men like Ed Kopira. The responses to these offers, first of earned reentry, then of pardon, were varied. By the time the offers were made, new lives had been established in Canada, new careers and new families, so the new Canadians were often reluctant to return. Of those who did accept these offers, the common reason was to gain the ability to travel in the United States, to visit family and friends, rather than to return to live.
I didn't take advantage of the Ford program because I didn't really feel that I should have to serve any other kind of commitment, because I didn't serve my full term in the Army, that I'm supposed to go back now and give so many months alternative service of either cleaning the streets or wiping off wind buttons or what, you know, or saying I like Nixon or something. I did go back under the Carter Amnesty Program because the Carter Program just said, look, you know, let's just forget, let's forgive, and let's go on.
So in 1985, what's your statement about war and peace? Can you imagine a war that you would fight in? Would you stick it out to the end for?
No. You know, there was a time when I was 20 years old, I might have considered that, you know. But I'm 35 now, and I would find the farthest and highest and most remote place I could get to rather than go to war again. So there's no reason for it. There's no reason that is a big enough reason to go out and kill somebody for. There's just no reason.
Is this a religious conviction?
Partly, yeah. Part of it is religion. Part of it is just common sense.
What advice would you have for your own child?
Run. Stay alive. My brother has two kids who are now, I think, 23 and 21. And when I was last down in the States, I was approached by him, and he pointed out to me that even though he did not agree with my action, would it be possible, should the draft come back to the United States, should his kids be in that position, would it be possible that I would have a place for these kids to stay, my nephews? And I pointed out that, you know, there is no problem, none whatsoever. If they need a place to go to, they've got one. Don't worry about it. You know, I've made the foothold. I've got, you know, we're strong now. Don't worry about it. Family can move. We can all get out of this together and alive.
Well, come on, all you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs to help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three.
The only conscientious objector that I... sticks in my mind was one that I met in Vietnam who put down his M16 after the first couple of weeks and refused to use it for the rest of his tour. And he was in the infantry, and he spent most of his time out in the bush. And he survived somehow.
I lost a job in Yakima once as a teacher my first year. A fellow named Clavino in the personnel office saw my 1WREL draft classification, and he said, well, what is this? And I mean, I had high marks, A's coming out of student teaching, got along well with kids, the highest of recommendations. I said, well, I've never seen a draft classification like that. What is it? And I said, well, that's a conscientious objector who's done his alternative service. Clavino got visibly upset and kind of pulled back in a defensive posture behind his desk and said, does that mean that you wouldn't say the Pledge of Allegiance? And I said, no, but it does mean I take liberty and justice for all very seriously. And there was some formalities after that, but it was clear to me that the interview was over and the answer was no.
I am not condemning people that don't believe in war, because I'll tell you the truth. The only thing that would prompt me to fight again is if my life or my family's life is in danger. If the fucking Reds climbed up the beaches of California tomorrow, man, I'd just get out my book on Marxism and learn how to cook borscht. So I'll be dipped in shit before I'll ever go and fight for a political ideal. I mean, it's all the same. It's just one pack of assholes replacing another pack of assholes, you know. I learned that in Vietnam.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Some of the people whom you've heard in this program have not been named at their request. This program, one of a series titled Another Kind of Courage, was produced and narrated by Phil Andrus with support from the Washington Commission for the Humanities, the state program of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Musical consultant was John Kurtzer. If you would like a cassette copy of this program or would like to comment about it, write Another Kind of Courage, Post Office Box 261, Chimicum, Washington, 98325. Again, Post Office Box 261, Chimicum, Chimacum, Washington, 98325.